Hi, this is Terry Nunn from Berlin, and you are listening to Nate on The Vinyl Guy.
Oh, that's a message I won't soon forget. Hey, everyone. Happy 2023. It's Nate, back from an extended holiday break and kicking off yet another year of podcast episodes for The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And I hope everyone listening had a great break, spent time with family, friends, and of course, the record player. And for those of you following my social medias, you probably know I spent quite a bit of time in November and December in the United States. I visited a lot of great record shops, spent time with some fantastic friends and collectors and dealers, and I even saw some great live shows. So a big shout out to everyone who I connected with on my travels. And I arrived back in Sydney just in time for Christmas Day and a positive COVID test. So, it wasn't too bad this time around, but it did force me to limit my activities. However, I am now back and ready to roll and have a great new episode for you today. Now, today, I'm sharing a conversation I had with Terry Nunn of Berlin, and she is an absolute delight. Berlin is one of those bands I still enjoy listening to, especially those early synth-heavy recordings. Very quirky, very earwormy. And they also have some very collectible records in the career of Berlin, especially the early releases. They've got a private press record, which we talked to Terry about today. We also discussed the record shop that Terry and her family owned, working with David Geffen, Giorgio Moroder, the global number one smash song Take My Breath Away for the Top Gun movie, Terry's audition for the Princess Leia role in the original Star Wars, and lots more. We cover it all today. Plus, we talk about the latest Berlin record, Strings Attached, orchestral renditions of classic Berlin songs available on vinyl at www.berlinpage.com. And FYI, we've got over 370 additional episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast available anytime through the very podcast app you're listening to the show on right now. So subscribe or follow the Vinyl Guide and have free, unlimited access to hundreds of interviews featuring musicians like Gerald V. Casale of Devo, episode 366, East Bay Ray of Dead Kennedys, episode 355, Tommy Chong of Cheech and Chong, episode 320, Kira Rossler of Black Flag, episode 304, Tom Scholz of Boston, episode 297, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, episode 249, and hundreds more. Follow this podcast and enjoy them all anytime. All right, with the upfronts done, let's get into the conversation with my teenage crush, Terry Nunn of Berlin, here on the Vinyl Guide podcast.
Can you see me? There you are.
Yes.
Hi.
How are you, Terry? How are things?
Great hair.
Oh, thank you. Terry, I'm so glad to have you on the show. I've always wanted to have you on. And what we do here is we talk about records. We're collectors at heart. And I don't know if you have a record collection. Do you still listen to vinyl?
I have the record collection because I can't throw it away ever. It's my life. It's part of my DNA, those albums, growing up with them. But I don't play them because I don't have a player.
Got it.
Am I terrible?
No. You're in the boat of a lot of people. Same sort of thing. It's like they know they want them. They know they have strong connections with them. But it is a pain in the ass to get everything set up and sorted. So maybe that's something you ask Santa for this year. A turntable, a good sound system. Because I tell you, all that energy, all those wonderful memories, they're still there. They're just waiting for you to, you know, break it out.
How often do you listen to your albums, vinyls?
Geez, 3 to 4 times a day. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's constantly on. It's somewhere else. My kids, they know how records work. They have no idea how CDs work. So they get the physics. And it's fun. It's arcane. It's
how old are they?
Oh, 13 and 15.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fun. I'd imagine that if you were able to set up a record player, you'd have some fun with it. What's in that record collection? Do you remember?
Oh my Lord. Everything from Crosby, Stills and Nash that I used to sing with my brother and his Barracuda. We would do harmonies and it was the only time he ever liked me. There was Bowie and Linda Ronstadt and Fleetwood Mac. and the New York Dolls and Carly Simon, Heart, you know, Roxy Music, James Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, we had record stores when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. We had one Ma and Pa record store, and then we opened up another one, and then we had three. That was huge, but that was way too much. The family couldn't handle that, so we went back down to one, and then we got knocked out by the big chains because we couldn't.
So you guys actually owned a record store. Oh, wow. Okay. This is in Southern California. What was the name of the record store?
Yeah. In Reseda, California. And I was 8 years old and I ran the cash register. And I played records all day because we had everything.
Wow.
You know, this was in the 60s. So this was, you know, when the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper came out, there was a line around the block. You know, we had the John Lennon Yoko Ono Naked album in the back because we couldn't put it out in the store, you know, all that stuff.
Wow.
And you're probably too young for that.
Well, I'm not too far away from those memories, but what was the name of the record shop?
Crown Records.
Crown Records.
And it was called Crown Records because we couldn't afford the sign, and it was Crown Cleaners, and they had this big ass sign in the front. So we thought, all right, well, let's just keep the sign and we'll just put records under it.
Wow. That is such a, that is such a record shop thing to do. So did you used to have back in the 60s, you know, you're in Los Angeles, you're in Southern California. You know, you must have had some rather famous folks come in to shop at your record shop.
Well, we did get Leonard Nimoy to do our grand opening because my mother worked for his business manager. And so he knew her and liked her. And she said, we're trying this record store idea. And we wondered if you'd come down. And he said yes. And in payment, he wanted one of my father's art pieces because my father did paintings. He did pen and ink a lot. And Nimoy loved his work. So he picked out one and went home with it. And that day was insane. I mean, I was a little young, so I didn't realize how big Star Trek was until we did that record store thing, because we didn't have the security to handle it. It was very exciting.
Wow. So you guys had the shop or it sounds like you expanded to like three record shops and then back down to two. How long a time period were the record stores being run?
From about 1966 to 1972.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
And do you remember dealing with any bootleg records, or do you recall any things that you said the John Lennon Yoko Ono Naked album had to be somewhere else? Any other records,
back,
comedy records and things that you had to hide and keep away from people, from the general public?
We did. I mean, that's the only record that I remember we had to hide there. Oh, what was the one, Procol Harum, where the girl was a young girl and she was topless and she's holding a plane.
Oh,
that's a
yes.
famous album
yeah.
cover. That
Blind
one
Faith.
We couldn't. Yes. Blind yeah. Faith. We couldn't put that one out.
Right.
So that also had to go in the back because she was naked and you could see nipples. And nipples, even now, nipples are, I don't know why nipples are a thing.
Nipples are the work of the devil. You know that. I mean, you know, that's that's the root of all evil. You know,
also the root of all of our food when we're born.
That's true. Man nipples fine, woman nipples, you know, devil's work.
Yeah, exactly.
So growing up in Los Angeles, you know, with family and friends in the entertainment industry, you being around these folks, I assume there was always the desire to be a performer. Was it pretty much a foregone conclusion for you?
It was a desire to make music somehow, because I love music so much. And I have realized in the years since that most musicians have social issues, myself included, severe most of the time. And what I found with music is that it was a bridge. It was a way that I could connect with people in a positive way and be less scared about connecting with people because I loved music so much, and so did others. So it was a way to connect, and it's really helped me. And I think it's that way for probably most musicians. I have not met a lot of very socially adept musicians anywhere.
When you talk about social issues, is it anxiety? Is it just difficulty communicating? Like, what's the?
Yes, 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 and yes.
Okay, all right.
Anxiety. I'm pretty good communicator, but anxiety, and I don't know. Just yeah, anxiety is a good word for it.
Okay, all right.
Yeah,
I've always thought. I mean, and even to the arts, and even the world in general, if someone has a really strong talent in one area, it generally means there's a significant deficiency in a different area.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So anyway, I loved music so much that it scared me. I wanted it so much. And I thought, well, I'd love to try the music thing and see if I have any talent. And if I don't, then I'll be a DJ. You know, I could play other people's music, and I could interview musicians. I can be part of it that way, because it didn't matter to me as much that it was my music. I like that it is, because I can make money doing that and have it even more part of my life. But it was also everybody's music, just being in it, just playing it and hearing it and playing it for people and turning people on to it is still. Now I'm passionate about it.
Was there a band or artist or record that really kind of switched on that light for you?
Many, many. We moved a lot. So it was really my only friend, the record player and my records. You know, it was something that was always there and would be there for me. So there weren't a lot of people to turn to in those years.
Was there anyone you wanted to emulate?
That I wanted to emulate. Usually the strong women like Carly Simon, like Grace Slick, Ann Wilson, Stevie Nicks, the women that weren't just the pretty ones, the ones that were strong and belted and sang rock and roll. I loved the strength and the power. And other than them, I liked men, you know, the male singers, really.
Now, being in Los Angeles that period of time, did you spend much time in with the punk community? Were you around with like X or Screamers or those sort of bands?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That seems easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. Now, being in Los Angeles that period of time, did you spend much time in with the punk community? Were you around with like X or Screamers or those sort of bands?
Interesting you said X, because that was my first punk concert that ever went to.
Okay.
Yeah, I was maybe 16 when I saw X, and it was a club called Club 88 in West Los Angeles. And it was the first time that I saw moshing and how they would, I mean, they were jumping from the second level into the crowd. It was just like, whoa, this is, I'd never, ever seen any kind of a concert like that.
Was it frightening or was it exhilarating? What do you
No,
recall?
It was exhilarating. It was really good. John Doe has an amazing voice. I think he's really underrated as a singer. He's a really good singer.
Yeah. And the combination with Exene, I mean, it's just divine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the band that you're most prominently known for, Berlin, has a real synth heavy sound, always reminiscent of bands like Kraftwerk and Devo. Was this music you were also really into at the time?
Devo wasn't happening yet. The Kraftwerk was one of our influences and Ultravox. John started the band in 1979. Berlin's celebrating its 45th anniversary this year. And I joined in 1979. So it at that time, we didn't know about Devo yet, but it was just starting to happen. The electronic music just starting to happen. But honestly, we were one of the first because there was nothing like that going on in Los Angeles. It was, you know, power pop and punk.
Right. You know? And the synthesizers that you guys were using were very expensive at the time.
Yes, we could only afford one, the Prophet 5.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's all we had. The whole first album was the Prophet 5. It was all we could do.
Back in the day when you guys were cutting those first records, yeah, it was probably $10,000 at the time.
Yep. And the TR-808 drum machine.
That
was our entire first album.
Wow. Would you guys carry that equipment to gigs?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Had to, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, as more synthesizers got made and got... became affordable, then, you know, we didn't have tracks then. So we had to hire, like for the first tour we did, we had to hire a second keyboard player to play it all, you know, because we had so many parts. So David Diamond couldn't do all the parts. So we had Matt Cohn who came in, Matt Reed, and he would do all the secondary parts. You know, it was layered.
Yeah.
Layered sound.
Again, this podcast is around vinyl records and those sort of collectibles.
Yeah.
The very first record of Berlin, I believe it was a private pressing, A Matter of Time and Overlord. Overload,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Tell me your memories of making that record.
I just thought that this music was special because it was so different from everything else that was going on. And it Matter of Time was just it was a really good song to me. And it caused us a lot of problems initially, you know, because people were like, well, where's the guitar? You know, where's the guitar solos and your skinny ties? And we weren't doing any of that. And so people didn't get it, but we've got better. And I think overall, it was really good. I think it gave us longevity because it's the advice I give to other musicians when they ask, you know, how do you make it in music? It's important to be excellent first, but it's even more important to be unique because then you're irreplaceable.
Mm-hmm.
If you sound like everybody else, you sound like everybody else. And you might be great at it, but it's already existing.
Yeah.
You know, you're superfluous. So I think that as hard as it was in the beginning for us to get going, it ended up being worthwhile that we kept going with it, that we kept, you know, trying to do something with this music that we loved, because it was weird.
Now, the private pressing, that was a record that the band made. Matter of Time and Overload. Did you guys all pitch in money for it? Do you remember how many were made of that record?
I don't think we could afford very much. I know that Pleasure Victim cost about $3,000 with the cover artwork that we all, kind of pitched in. And that is still to this day the biggest selling album of ours, of all of them.
Yeah. Now, Pleasure Victim, because that was on MAO Records, if I recall that right. Who was MAO Records?
That was, it was man from Cambridge, was MFC, which was our manager, mm-hmm. Perry Watts Russell. And MAO was something about man something Oxford, because that's also where he, I mean, he was a highly decorated scholar. But yeah, I mean, he, we didn't have a record label, so he kind of started his own kind of pressing, and we put it under his name until the first indie signed us, which was Enigma. And they had just started, and their first two signings were Berlin and Motley Crue.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
What a start.
So they did really well for themselves.
Now, Pleasure Victim was eventually re-released by Geffen. There were a few changes, a few additions. What was it like for the band going from Enigma and MAO to Geffen? What were the sort of changes in organization of the band at that point?
Getting to make money, getting to have, not much. I mean, you know, in this day and age, but to us, it was a lot. You know, it's like, wow, we're making money now. And we, you know, the difference was, you know, full on tours and getting that kind of support and getting to play around the country and around the world that would have us, you know, wasn't much in the beginning, really only Australia and Japan were opening their doors, your doors to us, because it was still kind of weird. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, that to be able to have that kind of support was huge. Geffen was amazing. He's an amazing man. He did everything he said he was going to do. He gave us the longest commitment, 3 albums instead of 2, which nobody else was offering. He believes in talent, and he loves talent, and he nurtures talent, and he supports it. And I honestly, that was a great business relationship. That was 11 years for me. And yeah, good man.
How hands-on was David with the band?
His MO was to hire really talented people and pay them well and trust their intuition. I think his opinion was the bottom line, but he had really great talent in that business, in that company that he took good care of. And so we dealt generally with our A&R person, and then our manager dealt with all of the other people, the publicists and the promoters and, you know, all of the other people in the company. So David was the figurehead, and he made the final decisions, the big decisions. But yeah, it was he had a lot of really good people under him.
So Pleasure Victim is this runaway hit. Berlin's all over the place. You guys start to put together the album that becomes Love Life. Was there a lot of pressure there? What was the thought going into that next record?
There was a lot of pressure for John, and I, now that he's back in the band, he rejoined maybe 4 years ago when he got a divorce, actually. And he's shared with me since what was going on with him then. And I, because he was tense all the time, and it really culminated in the working with Georgia Moroder on those 2 songs. No More Words and Dancing in Berlin, and then Giorgio getting the job for Top Gun at the same time. So we had a shot at actually, you know, doing one of Giorgio's songs. And John was just like, fuck, I'm trying to write something that everybody will like, that the band will like, because he was the main writer at the time, you know, that the record company will like, that the public will like. And I'm struggling, you know, to write these songs that will be good enough. And Giorgio Moroder flies in with this song and throws it on the table, and it becomes this huge, massive international hit all over the world. you know, one of 12 that he had that year. And I can't, you know, and I feel like my band's getting taken away from me, you know, that I can't do it. I'm not good enough. So he wasn't telling me any of this then. He was just mad all the time and tense all the time. And I was mad at him for being mad because all, you know, I was just loved Mike Howlett working with him, Georgia Moroder. I just loved, you know, his music and what he'd done with Bowie and Blondie and Flashdance and Cat People. And he was just amazing. You know, I just loved what he was doing. And John's not getting behind it. You know, he's, and, but I can see now, of course, that's, he would feel that way. Of course, you know, and, so, yeah, it was, for me, it was exciting. For John, my, you know, longtime partner, it was very stressful.
Was there always a tension in the band because, I mean, you were also the front person drawing a majority of the attention from magazine covers and press and things like that? Was that also something that John struggled with, or was he happy to be a little bit more in the background in that regard?
Yeah, the whole band had a problem with that. It and they don't now because, you know, there's a focal point, and the focal point also works more than everybody else. Because when they're getting off home, you know, I had to do the interviews and had to, you know, sign the stuff with the fans, you know, after the show and get up earlier and get hair and makeup, you know, just do all that, you know, it's more work. But people, when they're listening to music, they want a focal point. They want something to focus on because music, it's in the air. You can't focus on anything. You're just hearing it. Mm-hmm. So that's, for me, what a front person is. They're just a focal point. They're a way to look at something and just let it in. Just let in this great music. Hopefully it's great that they're there to hear. And that's what I do. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it took a while for the band to get that, but over time, you know, it got easier.
All right. So you're starting to work with Giorgio and mm-hmm. you hear rumblings of this song, this Top Gun song. What is your, mm-hmm. how is this song introduced to you, or that it exists? How do you learn that it exists?
Giorgio came in and said, I have this song and I'm doing this movie for, you know, Paramount. It is called Top Gun and it's going to be huge. And you should try to, you know, listen to this song. And I didn't know that we were not the first choice or even the like 10th choice. he had tried a number of singers on this because we weren't big artists then. I mean, he was literally producing our first top 40 hit, but it wasn't out yet. So, you know, we were kind of underground darlings, but not national or international anything at that point. And we were a last resort, really. So I, being the arrogant 20-year-old that I was, I didn't really like the melody the way he had done it. And, you know, I don't know. I just didn't think of, okay, it's Giorgio fucking Moroder and you don't mess with his melodies. All right. But I did, because I just thought, well, it's just not sounding, it didn't sound romantic to me. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I'm not going to get this anyway. So I'll just sing what I want. And I kind of massaged it into this a little different thing. And he probably let it go because he was already under the gun. They were saying, look, you know, we got to get this done. And so he just recorded it and gave it to them. They loved it. So now it's happening. And then in the studio, I kind of got a piece of his mind about some of it. It was like, yeah, but then we're not going to keep doing this. It's like, he was like, you know, we don't want all these extra notes. You know, people want to sing along, Terry. They must remember it. And you're singing too much. It's not going to be good. And so I would literally like keep trying it, like adding just a little bit here and there, and then go home And then he would hear it and he'd bring me back in. Nope. Take my breath away. Stop. No more. And I literally went home after the third time with him and said to my mom, well, it's ruined now. You know, it's never going to do anything now. But you know what? I did the best I could. I tried, but I had to do it the way you want it. So fine. You know, so it won't go anywhere. It was number one around the world. I mean, the guy, you know, he knew what he was fucking talking about and I needed to hear it. So I learned real fast.
How does having a number one hit globally, how does that change your life?
It opened up everywhere for us that nobody knew who we were or cared about us coming to play there. You know, we didn't get any offers from most countries. And that song, boom, you know, now everybody's like, hey, come on over. You know, we want to see you guys. So that was fantastic. But then John's even madder because now it's this huge hit and he doesn't want to play it because it's not our song. And I love it. And so now we're like this all the time. And he can't really share with me, you know, the fears he's going through because he's a guy and he's 20 and he, you know, so we just fell apart, you know, and we were tired. And it's nobody's fault. It's just been a lot of years of write, record, tour, write, record, tour, write. You know, the record label's pushing and pushing, wanting to keep that gravy train going. And we fell apart because we just really needed a few months off, but we didn't know that. And we turned on each other, you know, and now we realize that it was really not anybody's fault. I don't blame the record label. It's a business. They want to make their money. They want the music to keep going as long as it's going to go.
Yeah.
But I also see that that's why a lot of musicians die, because they don't know how to get off that hamster wheel. They don't know how to take the breaks. So they get drugs, because drugs give you a break for an evening. But unfortunately, drugs are also addictive, and then you got to take them every day, and then your body falls apart, and then, you know, your life falls apart. It's just this, you know, all it really needed to happen was people needed some balance in their lives, because music's great, but it's not everything. It doesn't hug you at night. You know, we needed lives. We needed friends back. I didn't have any friends. I wasn't home. You know, I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't have love in my life. What guy's going to hang around when I'm never around? So that was, it took a while to get that, but finally got there.
It's only been in the last few years where you and John have been able to have the conversations and look back. You know, you pay for wisdom with youth. So, you know, is it only really in the last few years that you've been able to really kind of piece these bits together and understand what was happening at the time?
Yes. Yeah, it really is. Mm-hmm. Because though we've been in touch for the last couple of decades, you know, he was with a wife who was not happy with him making music, who was very religious, and, you know, so he was stunted that way. And so we didn't see each other a lot because I was making music. And, you know, yeah, you're right. It's really been the last, since he's rejoined the band, that we've been able to talk about all that time and what happened.
Mm-hmm.
For both of us.
And so now the most recent Berlin album is with him composing again?
Correct.
Okay. Right. All right. So you've been able to kind of rekindle some of that initial songwriting magic that you had as the team.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you, Terry, as a record collector, do you know what the most collectible record is of the Berlin catalog?
Is my dog bugging you?
I love dogs. I'm okay.
Okay. So you don't mind? I mean, she's barking at something outside. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
No, I don't. What is it?
So a couple of ones. Metro and Tell Me Why on MAO. That single, you recall that single with the white sleeve, right? That's fetching on the collector's market between $100 and $150 each.
Wow. Yeah, there weren't many of those.
No.
Wow.
Were you involved that much in kind of the manufacture? Were there any DIY things? Did you get involved in the cover art? What was your involvement beyond the music on those singles?
No. I got involved in video concepts. For example, the No More Words video was a Bonnie and Clyde takeoff, and that was my idea because I got my first kiss watching that movie with Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway. I just thought they were so hot together. It was like, oh my God. And I was maybe, I don't know, 9. And I went with my boyfriend. He was 9. And it wasn't a very good kiss, not like with tongue in it or anything, but it was a kiss. Yeah. It was hot, you know, and I, it was watching Bonnie and Clyde. So yeah, that I thought, wow, that'd be a cool video. You know, we could just get the you know, the cars and have a shootout and I'll get to wear the Faye Dunaway beret and I don't know. She had these cool like 20s dresses that she was wearing. And anyway, yeah. So I was more of the visuals for the videos.
Right. And the cover of Pleasure Victim, where did that concept come from?
I don't know. That's David Diamond looking, a rendering of him looking into a TV screen. And that is a still from the Metro. We did a kind of homegrown Metro video that not many people have seen.
Mm-hmm.
God, I don't know if it's on YouTube even. And it's a still from that. It's not the one that we eventually did that came out when Geffen put out Pleasure Victim,
right.
But it's a still from that other one. And then, yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't able to find that on YouTube. I did find your Star Wars audition, which when you watch that Star Wars audition, what are your memories? What are your thoughts of it?
I just remember not knowing what the fuck I was talking about. It was like, what is a Darth Vader and an R2-D2? I have no idea what this is. I don't know what I'm saying. It hadn't been made yet. So it was just this script with words and names and trying to make this passionate, but without knowing anything about it at all. And literally just sitting in deck chairs with George Lucas, who was a kid, and Harrison Ford, who was a kid too, and I was a kid. And we're just trying out stuff. And yeah, I he liked me. He kept bringing me back, but I thanked him later for not hiring me, because there's just no way I would have been able to make music if I had been Princess Leia. There's just no chance of being taken seriously as a musician ever if I had done that job. So yeah, it was meant to be.
Yeah,
it was meant to be.
Yeah, yeah. Watching that video and it illuminated the fact that the gibberish that was being spoke was not part of the culture at the time. Who knew what the Death Star was? It must have been very awkward.
Yeah, it was. And Harrison Ford didn't like me. So yeah, just trying to get something out of him. You can kind of see at the end, I don't know, George Lucas says something that he said, oh, that was really good. And then Harrison Ford goes, yeah, was she okay?
Look, Terry, it's been lovely having you on the show. I want to be respectful of your time. Also want to call out the strings attached vinyl. That has become quite collectible as well, quite desirable. If you find a copy of strings attached vinyl, you probably want to grab it, because the collector's market is going cuckoo over that one too. Strings attached. Now, tell me just quickly, that's revisiting Berlin songs with orchestral arrangements.
Right. We played our songs with two Philharmonic orchestras. And I absolutely love orchestral music. So when we had that opportunity presented to us, I took it immediately. It was just amazing what they added to our music, because they added parts. It wasn't just playing what we had already done. It was making it bigger.
Right.
So fantastic. So yeah, strings attached is very cool to me too.
Terry, thank you so much. Be well.
Aww.
And again, pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. Okay. Thanks for including me.
Take care.
Oh, she is an absolute delight. Love to have her back anytime. Terry Nunn of Berlin. Again, the new album Strings Attached is available at berlinpage.com. It's on vinyl. The songs just sound very lush, very gorgeous, very worthwhile. So again, that's Strings Attached at berlinpage.com. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on Facebook. Tweet them out on Twitter if that still exists. And of course, leave us a positive review on whatever platform you're listening to this now. If you're Apple Podcasts, log in there. Give us a review, 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10. Say something nice. That is always very helpful. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some music, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.